Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. French voters are awaiting results in a presidential race being closely watched globally. VOA's Luis Ramirez tells us voters have spoken to news media about their opposition to both candidates, Marine Le Pen and Emmanuel Macron.
And that is something that I heard this morning. I went to a polling station right as it opened, caught the first batch of voters who lined up. That was at the very top of what they were saying. This has been such an ugly election. They don't like either candidate. And so in the case of a number of people who spoke to me, they were voting against one or the other. And it was in the instances that I people I spoke to, it was against Le Pen. People who support Macron or who are opposed to Le Pen, I should say, are very much frightened by her the policies that she is proposing.
The campaign of the French presidential frontrunner, Emmanuel Macron, says it was targeted by a massive and coordinated computer hacking operation on the eve of the final round of the voting for the country's next president. North Korea says it has detained another U.S. citizen, accusing him of committing hostile acts. The North's official news agency said that Kim Hak-sung was detained Saturday. The report said he had worked for the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology. Last month, Pyongyang detained Kim Sang-duk, a university accounting professor in his 50s. He taught accounting at Pyongyang University as well for about a month. That's according to the school's chancellor. North Korea has in the past detained U.S. citizens to use as bargaining chips. This is VOA News. After approximately 3 years in captivity, 82 schoolgirls kidnapped in 2014 by the militant group Boko Haram are going home. Nigerian government officials confirmed the releases early Sunday. The girls are set to be transferred to the Nigerian capital, where they will be received by the president. They will undergo medical testing before being reunited with their families. And in Nigeria, one of the founding members of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign, Buki Shoni Bare, speaking with Sky News, said it's exciting, but she also talked about the tough road ahead for the girls.
The girls that have returned, the life in captivity has been one that depicts suffering. It depicts the fact that they've been stabbed, they've been abused. As we've seen before, some of those girls have come back with children. Some of them have also come back, with news of how they have been sexually abused. So the life there is not one that can be explained and put in words. But the most important thing is that we're having them back, and I think that's very critical for us and the girls and the parents at this point.
The militants have seized at least 2,000 other girls and boys since 2014. Security forces in Iraq say two people were killed, six wounded, when militants attacked a base in northern Iraq where U.S. military advisors are stationed. It was not immediately clear if U.S. personnel were among the dead and wounded. Authorities say two of the insurgents were killed when their suicide vest detonated on the base located near Kirkuk. Three other militants were shot dead by Kurdish fighters. Reuters reports Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attack, saying it had killed and wounded dozens of crusaders and apostates, a reference to the forces and the Western military advisors. Iraqi forces backed by a U.S.-led coalition are fighting to dislodge Islamic State from Mosul. Police in the Indian-controlled portion of Kashmir say rebels have attacked a police squad, killing three civilians and a police officer. An assailant was also killed when officers returned fire. Officials say the police unit came under fire late Saturday when it was working to clear the site of a road accident. Various insurgent groups have been fighting for decades for Kashmir's independence from India. Merge with Pakistan, both countries claim all of Kashmir. The sister of U.S. President Donald Trump's son-in-law is in China courting wealthy people to invest $500,000 in luxury apartment towers outside New York as part of a program. Nicole Kushner-Meyer, the sister of Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was one of the president's top White House advisors and spoke Sunday in Shanghai. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
It rained on election day in Paris, and still there were people there right at opening time. So a line of people forming. The turnout appears to be pretty much what it has been in previous elections.
French citizens choose a new leader in what is being described as a bitter and acrimonious election.
Nigerians have been extremely happy because it's a sense that past administration didn't just care about this. So therefore, here is a serious leader who is helping to get back those girls.
82 Chibok girls released by Boko Haram meet Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari Sunday.
It is going to be a very serious titanic battle because all the opposition chiefs have come up together and have ganged up together.
And four major Kenyan political parties endorse incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta's re-election bid. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Polls are open in France, culminating a presidential election campaign that many French say is the country's most acrimonious and contentious in its modern history. The election could decide whether France stays the course of globalization or adopts a new separate path outside of the European Union. Viewer Louise Ramirez visited several polling stations and spoke to me about the latest developing regarding the election.
Well, I've been visiting a number of polling stations, some in central Paris, others in the suburban areas, talking to a wide variety of voters in multicultural neighborhoods and getting their views. And their views are quite diverse. In fact, some people choosing not to say who they voted for. One of the things that I've been getting consistently from voters is that number one, they're very determined. It rained on election day in Paris, and still there were people there right at opening time. So lines of people forming. The turnout appears to be pretty much what it has been in previous elections. The other thing that's very consistent among the voters I've been talking to is to put it very bluntly, a disgust with the way this campaign has been carried out and a disappointment with the candidates.
Some people are saying that the two hitherto main parties, the right and the left, are to blame for the choices that the country has now. What was the mood like when you went to some of these polling stations?
Well, let's start off with the fact that this election is all about countering the establishment. It is the first election in the history of the Fifth Republic of France, the republic set up by Charles de Gaulle, that does not include an establishment party. Both parties, the Socialist Party and the Conservative Party, were excluded from this race. So that tells you that going in, there is an anti-establishment sentiment. And that's exactly what we have. Two candidates. We have Emmanuel Macron, who quit the Socialist Party a number of years ago, and then ran not with any party, but rather as an independent. He started his own political movement a year ago, and he's managed to convince voters that he is a maverick coming in from the outside. Marine Le Pen, of course, belongs to the National Front Party, anti-immigrant, very much anti-Islamist. And, her party is a known entity, but also it is considered an outside party, not a mainstream party.
Did the voters mention at all any possible influence regarding the hacking of the emails?
I did ask people about that, and the answer I tended to get was that news came so late in the campaign, people by then had already made up their mind as to who they were going to vote for, who they were not going to vote for. So it is, and that combined with the fact that
that the dissemination of the material that was leaked was banned. The government told mainstream media that they faced very stiff penalties, legal penalties and criminal penalties even, if they released that information because it was coming within 24 hours of the election, that it didn't really get out there. And so it is questionable whether any leak like that would have had any will have any influence on this outcome.
When do they expect the results of this presidential election to be announced?
Well, in France, there is a tradition that preliminary results, which are very reliable, are released within minutes of polls closing. So it is right at the time the polls close that we will have official word on who won this election.
That view is Luis Ramirez covering the elections in France. He spoke with me from Paris. A spokesman says the 82 newly released Chibok girls met Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari in the capital Abuja Sunday. The girls were exchanged with detained suspected Boko Haram militants. Shehu Garba says the government would continue with efforts to ensure the release of the other girls who remain in captivity. 276 girls were kidnapped in 2014 from a government-run girls' secondary school in Chibok, a town near the Nigerian borders with Chad and Niger. To learn more about the released Chibok girls, I reached presidential spokesman Garba Shehu.
The president is quite pleased about this. As you know, it is a promise fulfilled. We're just reaping from, missed opportunities, getting them to come to rejoin their own families. Nigerians have been extremely happy because there's a sense that past administration didn't just care about this. So therefore, here is a serious leader who is helping to get back those girls.
Now that they are back, what are they doing now?
As we speak now, they are being transported to the capital, Abuja, and they will be meeting the president. Obviously, the issue of briefing and debriefing are acutely important. The health, their own welfare, and their fitness are matters that should obviously get immediate concern, because going by experience, whoever came out of the hostage situation in the Boko Haram area, in the hands of Boko Haram, they have mostly come out famished and undernourished, and some of them with the acute health challenges. So therefore, I believe government is in readiness for this. That obviously the briefing, because there must be some security interest in all of them. Some of them have been radicalized, nobody knows. So you need to know, or you probably can get leads as to how the others who are still in their captivity can also be taken, back in. So therefore, there are so many things that probably can start from here.
Some people are asking the next group of people still being held in captivity. Are there any efforts? And critics have said that the government hasn't been too transparent. Officials of the government are not too keen when they are asked about efforts to have all these girls released by Boko Haram. What do you say to that?
It is in the nature of things that people will criticize the government, especially when they don't know what is happening. It's been a difficult thing for the Nigerian government, because when you consider that Boko Haram is not just holding Chibok girls hostage, they have so far they have freed between 20,000 to 25,000 other hostages, mostly women and children and young men who have been conscripted into the fighting force of the Boko Haram. So the president has a focus on every citizen, and every citizen's life is important. And that's why it's difficult to balance, especially given this weight of responsibility on him and the fact that the Chibok girls deservedly have gained the attention of the whole world, more than just any other citizen.
Will the parents of these newly released 82 Chibok girls be present to meet with the president as well? I'm asking this because some of the parents and others in Nigeria are saying that the parents do not have access to the previous girls' release, and that all these measures that the government has taken usually frustrates them. What do you say to that?
Two things, yeah. One, is to say that if you are talking about this set of girls, 82 released yesterday, as we speak, they are still in transit. And they're being ferried into Abuja, I believe, by road, by air, and all of that, from remote, perhaps across the border. I can't tell you all of this until I know, but they are in transit. They are not here. We haven't seen them as we speak to you in Abuja. What we assure you is that they are in the hands of the authorities. That's one. So unless they are here, you can't talk about who is there and who can meet them. That's one. And two, if you are talking about the earlier 21 girls who had been here, government, as much as possible, had tried to allow access to family members. The thing to note is that you can't take chances with these girls, because if you throw them out there into the mainstream, assuming that Boko Haram grabs quite a number of them and then they take them back into custody and all of that, wouldn't that embarrass everybody? So I think that the government must show consideration. And people, other opposition, should show consideration. Government is doing the best it can. These girls have to be, some of them have to be de-radicalized, and then they have lost out in terms of training and school. And government has taken responsibility like any guardian can do so. So it should be to the relief of actually the parents that they're being catered for at the public expense.
Garba Shehu is a spokesman for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with me earlier from Abuja. Political parties and other stakeholders in the Kingdom of Lesotho plan to hold a national dialogue ahead of the June 3rd election. South African Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa was tasked by regional leaders to be the mediator of the dialogue. But opposition groups in Lesotho say Prime Minister Pakadita Mosesidi is to blame for the talk's delay. Meanwhile, the Independent Electoral Commission has warned political parties not to undermine the integrity of the electoral body before the poll. For the latest development, I reach Mutumi Ralejo, spokesperson for Prime Minister Mosesidi.
As a government, we learned of that while we were attending a SADC meeting in Swaziland. But since the facilitator, who is also the deputy president in South Africa, was tasked with the responsibility of organizing that, our belief was that he was going to spearhead that dialogue. But since this is the snap elections, Peter, we all understand the challenges facing the country with regard to a dialogue in the first instance, and also bearing in mind that there were many challenges in Parliament. One, there was a motion of no confidence that was preceded by Parliament itself refusing to actually pass the budget for 2017-2018. And that ended up in court. The case was heard last Tuesday, and the judgment is expected on the 12th of May 2017.
Your party, the ruling coalition now, has signed a declaration to accept the outcome of the elections. What do you think are your realistic chances that the people in Lesotho will back Prime Minister Pakadita Mosesidi?
Very strong chances, my good friend. You'll understand and realize that in Lesotho, the main political parties have two ideologies, the Congress ideology and the nationalist ideology. Main ideologies that started when we had our first elections in 1965. However, we have other parties that are coming up today that are beginning to encourage people not to look for the nationalists or the Congress parties, but to be in the middle and to also believe that you must understand that you are Mosotho first. So having said that, the Congress parties now are beginning to come together, because in 1993, as we all may recall, the Congress parties won all constituencies in the countries but one. And after that, we have won 72, and then we've been declining until recently, now that we're going for the 2017 June 3rd elections, that we agreed to work together as the Congress parties who are believing in the same ideology.
The Electoral Commission, Independent Electoral Commission, is not pleased about some political parties expressing concern that some of these parties who were giving monies to run elections have yet to account for the monies given to them.
Two things, Peter, on this one. The Independent Electoral Commission its election period gives out money to political parties registered to contest elections for them to be able to campaign. But now, what has surprised everybody is that they have now come out because they're supposed to be issuing those monies again this time around in a week or so to political parties contesting elections. Now they're saying that other parties in 2015 were given monies, but they haven't actually cleared that. They haven't actually accounted for such monies. But surprisingly, my good friend, we are 2 years and 2 months to date since the last elections. And the question is, how is Independent Electoral Commission auditing its own books? Because we believe that each authority, it is audited every year. We believe also that it is the responsibility of each and every political party that has benefited with this campaign fund to always, always ensure that after elections, they do audit and clear their names with the Independent Electoral Commission.
Motumi Raleju is the spokesman for the Prime Minister of Lesotho, Pakadita Musisidi. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. Four major Kenyan political parties endorsed incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta's re-election bid for his second term at ceremonies held in the capital, Nairobi, Saturday. The parties include Chap Chap, NARC Kenya, KANU, and the Economic Freedom Party. The president is said to face a stiff challenge from former Prime Minister Raila Odinga in the August 8th presidential vote. For the latest update, I reach Kenyan political analyst James Mwamu.
That was expected. He's the one that they were going to endorse to run for his second term. But this time, I think it's going to be a little bit difficult. One, for two reasons. You know, in 2013, they relied on the issue of the ICC to campaign against the opposition. The issue of ICC is no longer there. And then they were able to galvanize their tribesmen to vote for them because they were saying that the opposition, especially the Right Honorable Raila Odinga, was the one who was using the ICC to persecute them. It is going to be a very serious titanic battle because all the opposition chiefs have come up together and have ganged up together. And they are coming from they are bringing in huge electorates together. So it's going to be a difficult time for the government.
Don't you think with the power of incumbency that most African leaders enjoy, Uhuru Kenyatta could pull it off despite the huge numbers that the opposition NASA could pull to challenge him?
Yes, that is a real possibility. That's a real possibility, especially the fact that in Africa you find that incumbents, because they have state resources, they have state power, they have the army and the police on their side, they are likely to use those instruments to make sure that the opposition does not win elections. But even if the opposition wins elections, they sometimes use strong-arm tactics. That's a likely possibility that is going to be there. But even when that happens, it's going to be still very difficult for them to win an outright election. What I see is that there's a possibility of going for a rerun. There's a possibility of going for a rerun because I don't think they are going to meet the requisite numbers to give them 50 plus 1.
Issues of ethnic vote have been raised time and time and again. How significant is this particular ethnic vote in this election?
It is going to be still a reality in this coming elections because basically the government there has very strong ethnic groups that come together. However, NASA brings in about five ethnic groups together. But in addition to the ethnic reality that is going to be there in this election, there is also the issue of the hardship, the high inflation rate that is in the country, and the prices of goods and commodities, basic commodities that the common man relies on, has gone very high. So even in those areas where the government enjoys a lot of support, people are feeling the serious economic pinch in the sense that there's a serious economic pinch in the sense that the prices of things have gone up and people are not able to afford basic commodities. So even in the battleground areas, you know, that is where the battle is going to be. The battleground areas a lot of people are very angry, disenchanted by the government and what they're doing. So the ethnic factor is a reality, but there are also other factors that are going to influence the outcome of this election.
James Mwamu is a Kenyan political analyst. He spoke with me from Nairobi. For over a decade now, Ugandans have been grappling with the succession talk. President Yoweri Museveni has been in power since 1986, and some Ugandans fear that he may want to handpick a successor by the end of his term in 2021. Speculation about the president's plans are rife within the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM, and the main opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. Godber Tumashabi is the Associate Director of the Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies. For VOA, he spoke with reporter Halima Atumani.
I think it is perfectly okay for a political party like FDC, like NRM, to say we are dealing with a transition if they choose to run their parties as a monarchy. But for Uganda, which is not a monarchy, we are talking about a transition. And in the case of Uganda, the debate becomes inevitable because President Museveni is ineligible to contest for another term of office because he already have clocked the age limit by the time he completes his term of office in 2021. So the debate about transition and how to ensure a peaceful transition from Museveni to another president becomes inevitable by operation of law.
So you're insisting on using the word transition and not succession.
Absolutely.
I think the reason why Ugandans keep talking about succession is the fact that we've heard about the Muhoozi Project, a son of the president. We've also had some reports that maybe the first lady would also want to be a president of Uganda. So for them, it is a family affair. Should we then not be discussing that on that basis?
Yeah, but you see, they cannot set the debate and we follow it and they become the beneficiary. That's why we are saying whether it is Muhoozi, whether it is Janet, whether it is someone else, it is still a transition from Museveni to another president by applying our law. So I think people like Muhoozi and Kataha are all eligible to contest as presidents of Uganda. What happens within their parties on how they win the flag of their parties could be a succession debate. But I don't think that debate applies to Uganda as a country.
The reason why Ugandans are having this succession talk and not necessarily transition talk is that we have a president who has been in power for the last 31 years. I think 2021 mm-hmm. he will be making 35 years.
Yes.
And there is fear that maybe he will not be able to relinquish power peacefully. Should we have that fear?
The fear should be there if we think we are incapable as citizens to be able to demand that every leader follows the law. But I think that Ugandans have reached a certain level of civic maturity that they appreciate that they have the power to shape and change the circumstances around them. And I think that that was evident in the last elections where people went out and voted and they knew their votes had been stolen. And you could see that the dead silence was really a form of protest. So I think we should be concerned how the transition process is managed, where people like President Museveni and other leaders are guaranteed secure and dignified retirement. And I think that should be, for me, the bottom line.
Right now, we're hearing talk about possible change in the constitution, which has started with our civil servants trying to amend the constitution so that they can increase their age and stay in their offices. And maybe eventually it will end up with the president extending his stay.
I think that there is a possibility that President Museveni may just catch the curse of other Africa's strongmen and actually lack the courage to follow the law and therefore work to manipulate and maneuver the constitution and remove age limit. I think that cannot be ruled out, but it is our responsibility as Ugandans to actually challenge him and challenge all our leaders and actually increase the risks for them to do things that have essentially moved other countries to the brink of war. Yeah, because short of a peaceful transition of power from Museveni to another leader, and that leader could be in NRM, could be in any other party. Short of that, the possibility of violent and armed resistance become inevitable because you see, the history of Uganda is such that almost every other government has tried to suffocate and kill the opposition. The consequence is that opposition normally emerges from within the ruling clique, or Ugandans take the option of armed resistance.
Godbertu Mashabi is the Associate Director of the Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies. He spoke with reporter Halima Athumani from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. And good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with athletics. On Saturday, Olympic champion Eliud Kipchoge produced the fastest ever time for the marathon distance at the Breaking 2 race in Monza, Italy, running 2 hours and 25 seconds. But because in and out pacemakers were used, the time will not be recognized as a world record, meaning Dennis Kimuto's mark of 2 hours, 2 minutes and 57 seconds is still the quickest. Eliud Kipchoge missed out on becoming the first athlete to run under 2 hours for the marathon by 26 seconds. Held on a racetrack at 5:45 a.m. local time, Kipchoge lined up alongside half-marathon world record holder Zesinai Tedesi of Eritrea and 2013 world silver medalist Lelisa Desisa of Ethiopia to try to become the first man to cover 26.2 miles within 2 hours. Tedesi crossed the line several minutes later in 2 hours, 6 minutes and 51 seconds, while Desisa followed in 2 hours, 14 minutes and 10 seconds. Monza was chosen by the sportswear company for its gentle corners and favorable climatic conditions. The brand paid the three runners to forego the London and Berlin marathons this year. Nike's big corporate rival Adidas is planning its own sub-2-hour marathon attempt, but wants to do so in a race setting. Meanwhile, in Doha, Haivin Kiyang clocked the sixth fastest performance ever in the women's 3,000-meter steeplechase to highlight action on the track at the opening meeting of the 2017 IAAF Diamond League Series. The world champion kicked away from compatriot Beatrice Chepkoech and world record holder Ruth Jabet as she approached the final barrier, pulling away to a 9:00.12 victory. The Olympic silver medalist has now twice come frustratingly close to the event's 9-minute barrier. Her personal best still sits on that cusp at 9:00.01. Rio's 800 meters medalists Kasper Semenya and Margaret Wambui showed 1500 meters world record holder Genzebe Dibaba what true 800 meters running is all about in the Ethiopia's debut half-mile race. The 26-year-old was first in line behind pacer Jenny Medwars, who led the field through 400 meters in about 58 before the true 800-meter runners took control. The towering Wambui, bronze medalist in Rio, was first to attack as Jamaica's Natoya Gole snuck to the inside of Dibaba. On the backstretch, two-time Olympic champion Semenya made a calculated move to bypass the field and win by half a second in 1:56.61, a new meet record and world lead for 2017. Kiang's performance was one of six world leads on a typically warm but windy evening in Doha's Qatar Sports Club Stadium. Her compatriot Ronald Pwemoy, better known as a 1500-meter runner, kicked away to take the evening, capping 3,000 meters in style in 7:28.73, chopping 25 seconds from his personal best. Olympic 5,000-meter silver medalist Paul Chilemo of the U.S. was second, with Ethiopia's Yomif Kajelcha, the world indoor champion over the distance, coming in third. Another world lead came in the men's high jump, Qatar's of Qatar's biggest athletics star, Mutaz Bashim, who finally notched an IAAF Diamond League victory before his home crowd. Jamaica's double Olympic champion Elaine Thompson beat world 200-meter champion Daphne Schiffers to win in 22.19. Chiffers was second in 22.45 with Marie-Jean Latoll of the Côte d'Ivoire coming in third. And Akan Simbine won the season's first major global 100 meters showdown, powering away from the field over the final 10 meters en route to his first career IAAF Diamond League triumph in 9.99. Asaf Powell held on to finish second, with local favorite Femi Ogunude coming in third. Finally, in football, Uganda Cranes will face South Sudan in the 2018 Championships of African Nations, CHAN qualifiers, in July. South Sudan booked the fixture after ejecting Somalia 4-1 on aggregate following the return leg at Juba Stadium. Africa's newest country will host the first leg on July 14th before traveling to Kampala for the return leg a week later. The competition is meant for home-based players only. The winner of the tie will face either Tanzania or Rwanda to seal a spot in the 2018 tournament that will be hosted by Kenya. Reigning champions DR Congo won the championships in 2009 and 2016, while Tunisia and Libya won in 2011 and 2014, respectively. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
J'ai peu de l'autre femme, les mains. Ou toujours pressé, j'ai tout partout. Ou fait être moins vivé. Ou fait tout ça, moins haï, chéri. Pourtant c'est où, moi, mais. Oh, pourtant c'est où, moi, mais. Chéri. Ou fait tout ça, moins haï, chéri. Pourtant c'est où, moi, mais. Pourtant c'est où, moi, mais.
yon sa toune yon kase Chéri, katouye msa mpa kone La mette nou nan chagre Relasyon sa pi malke l'enfer Chéri, la fesan bire l'enfer La mette nou an bate Mwen kade nan glas, mwen wey yon moun chéri Sa toune yon kase Chéri Katouye msa mpa kone La mette nou nan chagre Relasyon sa pi malke l'enfer Chéri La fesan biye l'enfer La mette nou an bate
Thank you, Lord, oh, everything where I get now your blessing. I wanna see my mama riding God, oh, someday I cannot stop. Thank you, Lord, oh, everything where I get now your blessing. I wanna see my mama riding God, I do someday. Cannot stop. Moula, je dors pas la nuit. Dehors pour chercher le puissant. Ils diront femme là et diront oui, je crois. À genoux devant le Christ. Man, j'avance avec ceux qui veulent bien me suivre. J'ai failli d'être, j'ai pas le temps, il faut que je puisse. Ah, eh, Nassi Bentol Lambo. Bitch, I want more. For my pretty girls, yeah, yeah. Thank you, Lord, oh, everything where I get now your blessing. You, I wanna see my mama riding God, oh, someday I cannot stop. Thank you, Lord, oh, everything where I get now your blessing. You, I wanna see my mama riding God, oh, someday I cannot stop.
Don't play with us, Lord. Don't play with us, Lord. No. Don't play with us, Lord.
S'ils pensent qu'on s'arrêtera là, ils se sont trompés.
une villa pour la maman, telle est la visée.
La visée, la visée.
Un seul maloba.
Yimo.
Tell them they need to know. Oh, oh. I get this feeling in my heart. Oh. I put this feeling on the beat and my people go crazy. I get this feeling in my heart. Oh. I get this feeling that my dreams can come true. Yeah, yeah. I get this feeling in my heart. Oh. I put this feeling on the beat and my people go crazy. I get this feeling in my heart. Oh. I get this feeling that my dreams can come true. Yeah, yeah.
Say you want to the carry go. I supposed to know. Say you won't go solo. On your own, all alone. Child, I don't know. Oh, girl, you're driving me crazy. Out of my mind, I cannot hide. I've been thinking about you lately. No matter how hard I try, I cannot find. Sometimes I get so frustrated.
And that was our Sunday's music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Every African should be outraged by the recent trend in South Africa to bring the judiciary into the partisan politics of the country. Since the end of apartheid in 1994, the international community and all concerned, even in South Africa, have seen the South African judiciary as independent, competent, and an asset to democracy in South Africa. However, it has become the practice of the opposition, particularly the Democratic Alliance, to use the judiciary in its political fight with the ruling African National Congress of South Africa. In some instances, the resort to the court has been judicious and correct. But recently, they have gone to the brink. And this is one of the reasons why South Africans and Africans should be concerned. Because it is also true that African states and politicians are now being held to different standards than others in the international community. We have seen that the International Criminal Court has held African leaders to different standards compared to others. And this dangerous trend to use the South African judiciary in the political fight should be halted. Recently, the South African government, President Zuma, reshuffled his cabinet. And this has caused tremendous political upheaval, not so much because of the reshuffle, but because of what was called, quote-unquote, the removal of a competent finance minister from the cabinet. Now, the Democratic Alliance has resorted to the court and requested the court to demand that President Zuma reveal his reasons with records for the change of the finance minister. This is highly unprecedented in political governance worldwide. Where heads of the world demanded any head of state or head of government to explain why they have reshuffled their cabinet or removed certain ministers. It is now known in many parts of Africa that in ministers who have been sacked from cabinet could only find out over the radio or through gossip columns. What are the implications if heads of states and government have to explain why they have removed particular ministers from the government? And this is one of the reasons why it is very sad that the South African judiciary, which otherwise has been very competent and independent, is abandoning judicial restraints. And the matter should not be left only to the African National Congress to push back at the strain. Africans in South Africa, pundits in South Africa, should say no to the South African judiciary in delving into the political disputes between the government and the opposition. There are options left to the opposition. If the opposition disagrees with the reshuffle or the removal of a particular minister, the political options open to them, one, they could mobilize public opinion and have demonstrations. They could resort to parliament and have a vote of no confidence. The fact that they may not have the vote in parliament does not give the opposition the right to try to pollute the judiciary to win a political battle. And the reason why this is so important is that if we allow this trend to continue, it will be the harbinger of a disruptive political governance in the whole of Africa. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if you search for the laws of harmony, you will find knowledge. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From time to time, the United States identifies certain individuals as important to the operations or future plans of a terrorist organization. In all cases, these are people who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. When such an individual is identified, the U.S. government places that person's name on the specially designated nationals list. His assets within U.S. reach are frozen, and he is locked out of the global financial network. No U.S. citizen or company may conduct business with a designated individual. In this way, the United States disrupts financial support networks for terrorists and terrorist organizations. On April 13th, the U.S. Department of State identified two Canadians as global terrorists. Tariq Sakhar is a Syrian-born Canadian citizen who has conducted sniper training in Syria and periodically travels to Turkey. Sakhar has been linked to the foreign terrorist organization and specially designated global terrorist group Al-Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria. Farah Mohammed Shirdan was born in Toronto, Canada, of Somali parents in 1993. He joined ISIS in 2014, where he also became known as Abu Usama al-Somali. Shirdan is an ISIS fighter and is also involved in recruiting, fundraising, encouraging others to commit violence, and spreading propaganda. Both Tariq Sakhar and Farah Mohammed Shirdan have been named specially designated global terrorists under Executive Order 13224. This action notifies the U.S. public and the international community that Sakhar and Shirdan are actively engaged in terrorism. Designations of terrorist individuals and groups expose and isolate organizations and individuals and result in denial of access to the U.S. financial system. Moreover, designations can assist or complement the law enforcement actions of other U.S. agencies and other governments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.